Good evening. Honored guests, it is my pleasure to welcome you to the presentation of the Dickinson College's annual Benjamin Rush Award. The award and lecture were established for the generosity of the late Wilbur M. Rabinowitz, a former trustee and member of the class of 1940. Each year since 1985, the college has presented an award in the memory and legacy of our founder, the esteemed Philadelphia physician, Dr. Benjamin Rush. The purpose of this award is to recognize outstanding achievement in the field of business or government, and to honor an individual whose career has been distinguished by a commitment to the ideals and values of a liberal arts education. Dr. Rush saw the importance of business and government. We must remember that under President Adams, he served as the director of the U.S. Mint. He saw the importance of business and government to the then forming country. He was an early advocate of manufacturers, his word for business, as being essential to the success of the new republic. Without it, he said, we would not survive, and felt that those involved in the industry would benefit from a liberal arts education that was at once respectful of the best lessons of history and progressive, in that we did not only emphasize Latin and Greek, but we ventured out into those languages such as German and French and Spanish that would be part of the commerce of ideas and goods. There could be no greater tribute to celebrate the intentions and convictions of Dr. Rush than this award. A revolutionary and signer of the Declaration of Independence, Rush was passionately committed to ensuring the success of the new democracy and the fledgling economy. Rush knew that the new nation could live up to its own expectations only if it was inhabited by citizens and leaders educated through an approach to liberal arts that was distinctly American. It was for this express reason that Rush founded Dickinson College. Rush's vision and legacy continue to guide Dickinson College today. We continue to strive to prepare our students to become the citizens and leaders of our communities, our country, and our world by offering them a liberal arts education that is both challenging and ultimately useful. This is the legacy we honor tonight as we present the Benjamin Rush Award. We can think of no better way to express our commitment to Dr. Rush's vision than by recognizing those who have demonstrated the value of these ideals through their successful lives and careers. As you will learn this evening, our guest, Mr. Charles Cole, used his own liberal arts background as a launching point to an extremely successful business career and a life of leadership and work within his community. It is indeed a pleasure to have Charlie with us, and also his wife, Barty. She is also with us this evening. Thank you, and welcome, Barty. My initial introduction to Charlie several years ago was through the chair of Dickinson's Board of Trustees, Jennifer Ward Reynolds, class of 1977, who is also with us tonight.
You are, Jennifer. Good to see you.
Charlie has been a longtime mentor of Jennifer, so she suggested that we might make a good addition, that he might make a good addition to the board's Committee on Investments, given his background. And she was certainly right. You can tell when Charlie is in the room. Charlie will always challenge us, always say, I have a modest question. I'd just like to ask about this. And then forward goes the conversation. We know Dr. Rush would approve for that revolutionary but subtle approach. It is now my distinct pleasure to turn the podium over to Ted Dressel, who will introduce our speaker. Ted is a sophomore majoring in international studies with a concentration on the Middle East. He is a member of Alpha Lambda Delta Honor Society, treasurer for Delta Sigma Phi fraternity, and has made Dean's List each of his three semesters at Dickinson. As evidence of his own commitment to his community, this Eagle Scout has been active with a local Cub Scout pack here in Carlisle, and he participated in the Serve the World service trip to the Dominican Republic over winter break. This past summer, he participated in Dickinson's first Sustainability in the Middle East study abroad program, and he plans to study in Jordan next year. All of these experiences will serve him well, as his future plans include becoming a foreign service officer for the U.S. Department of State. Ted, please come forward to introduce our speaker.
Thank you, President Durden. Good evening. As President Durden has said, my name is Ted Dressel, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum and Dickinson College, it is my honor to welcome all of you to tonight's Rush Award lecture titled Light at the End of the Tunnel. This year's recipient, Charles W. Cole, Jr., exemplifies the ideals of the Rush Award. Charles Cole worked for 34 years with the First Maryland National Bank and First Maryland Bank Group. He served as president of the First Maryland National Bank for 17 years. In 1984, Mr. Cole became the bank's CEO. In his 10 years that he served as CEO, the First Maryland National Bank achieved a compounded growth rate of over 20%, a growth rate which at the time was unmatched by the 100 largest banking companies in the country. In addition to Mr. Cole's successful banking career, he has been an important community leader. He was vice chairman of the United Way of Central Maryland campaign in 1982 and was awarded the Henry A. Rosenberg Sr. Distinguished Citizens Award from the Boy Scouts of America in 1992. He served as a member of the Board of Regents of the University System of Maryland and the Board of Directors of the University of Maryland College Park Foundation, where he has served as chairman of the Finance and Investment Committee. He is currently trustee of numerous institutions and a member of the Investment Committee of Dickinson College. At this time, I would like to ask that you turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. And please hold all questions until the end for the question and answer session following the lecture. And now, please join me in welcoming this year's Rush Award recipient, Mr. Charles W. Cole, Jr.
First off, good evening. And I want to say it twice. I stand here humbled to receive the Rush Award. Obviously, we're at Dickinson College. We're talking about higher education. We're talking about liberal arts. And we're talking about an international overview. Now, all of you know what I'm about to say in a moment. You're here most of the year, but not all the time. But for a person who's here just for one day, like myself, I'm not too sure you realize the wonderful trajectory that Dickinson College is under at the present time. The reputation continues to go up and up. So I racked my mind, how could I really convey this to everybody? And then I said, oh my goodness, I have it right here. I brought two slides. Now, you look at gold, up to 2005, kind of flatlined, and then it took off. That's Dickinson. Terrific. So that's where you are today. The reputation is terrific. Now, do you realize how lucky you are? You have Jennifer Reynolds as your chairman. She's a Dickinson graduate. She was successful in business. Active on outside organizations, many of them, and her passion for this institution is terrific. Now, in addition to that, Mr. Bill, I'm not going to say much about him. He's world class. I'm going to comment on him in just a little moment. Now, there's a Japanese proverb which says, if you're going to preach a sermon, I'm not going to preach a sermon, you need to know your congregation. So I think I know the congregation. It's smart, it's dedicated, and it's ethical. And believe me, the business community needs you. Now, we're all the product of our past. And I know that my, call it bio, has been reviewed. But I want to go back and pick certain pieces out of it tonight because I think it could very well lead to some questions later on. I spent 34 years at First Maryland Bank Corp. First National Bank of Maryland. The last 17 years, I was president and chief administrative officer, and then the last 10 years, I was CEO and chief administrative officer. Now, for the first 5 years as the CEO, we were 50% owned by the Allied Irish banks. Fortunately, earnings went up 20% a year for 5 years. The Irish fell more in love, made a tender offer, and bought all the rest of the shares. So that during the final 5 years, we were 100% owned by the Allied Irish banks. Bear in mind, earnings increased 20% a year for a decade. And then AIB destroyed First Maryland, a company founded in 1806. Tragic. Then what happens? A couple of years later, AIB blows up. Their stock at one point had reached a ceiling of $72 a share. Now it's a ward of the state, trades at around 60 cents. They must have loaned money to everybody who walked in the front door. Tragic. Now, following that, I spent roughly 5 years with Alex Brown Capital Advisory and Trust Company, wholly owned subsidiary of Alex Brown, a company, a longstanding Maryland company, founded in 1800. Toward the end of that five-year period, the executive management of the parent company and the board sold Alex Brown to Bankers Trust, which promptly went down the tubes and had to be rescued by the Deutsche Bank. Tragic. The trust company, which I was vice chairman of at that time, was spun out, and today the firm is called Brown Advisory, which is a state-chartered trust company with a brokerage arm. So that company exists today, and it's doing well. After being there for several years, Chip Mason, chairman and CEO of Legg Mason, called me and said, "Why don't you come and be chairman and CEO of Legg Mason Trust Company, wholly owned subsidiary of Legg Mason?" Now, Legg Mason was a rocket going along. Stock had gone to 140, 145. And then due to gross mismanagement, the company blew up. Stock went down to 7, and the company in 1 year lost a total of $2 billion. Tragic. So I just wanted to touch on those experiences because that may very well lead to questions on what happened and why. The one outside organization I would comment on would be University of Maryland System. In 1988, Governor William Donald Schaefer created the University of Maryland System, which oversees today 12 universities. The largest one and probably the best known is College Park. So I happened to be picked as one of 11 or 12 regents. So I spent the next 10 years as a regent working very closely with 12 presidents of universities. I can tell you, you have the best rate here in Bill. Terrific, because I have all that comparison. I congratulate you. Now, yeah. Now, let's turn to the topic of the night. Is there light at the end of the tunnel? Subheading, economies, financial markets, job opportunities, and how about suggestions on designing an investment portfolio? That's kind of a handful. But let me just start off by saying the following. Warren Buffett says, if you're born in America, you have won the lottery. America's best days are ahead, and I believe that. I want to repeat it. Warren Buffett says, if you're born in America, you won the lottery. America's best days are ahead, and I happen to believe it. Now, having said that, getting from point A to point B is going to be challenging. And let's start on item number one, and it's a four-letter word, and it's called debt. Now, when you leave here, if you borrow money to buy a home, fine. If you've borrowed money to come to Dickinson to receive a fabulous liberal arts degree, terrific. But let's go to Washington. What a mess we have. Now, let me see if I can remember to hit. Here we go. This tells the whole story. And what, at the bottom line, I'm just going to kind of summarize here. The federal government today, and I know many of you know this, is borrowing 40 cents on the dollar. Think about that, 40 cents on the dollar. If any one of you borrowed 40 cents on the dollar, it wouldn't take long before you're bankrupt. Now, if you take... Now, let me just go to the accounting part of the federal government at the moment, because this is important. Federal government operates on a cash basis. If you went ahead and put the federal government on an accrual GAAP basis, and then you took a look at Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and then you got to hunt around in the numbers for the liabilities on Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, and then take the liability of the FDIC and put them together, what do you think? What do you think the unfunded liabilities for our nation are? It's not billions. It's $100 trillion. $100 trillion. How could we ever have gotten into that mess? We send Republicans, we send Democrats to the Congress, to the White House, and this is what they've delivered. Now, I want to also say that, you know, it's not like they're in Washington. They're there because we elect them. We're out there voting. They're our representatives. And this is what they've delivered. You know, Einstein once said there are two things in life that are infinite. The universe and human stupidity, and I'm not sure about the first. Also, there's a wonderful... Now, not everybody in Washington is deficient. There's a wonderful senator from Oklahoma, Mr. Colburn, and he says we got to stop taking stupid pills because all we're doing is running the debt up. 10,000 people a day are going on Medicare. This needs to be addressed. Now, let's go to the military for a moment. What has China been doing for the last decade? They've been going around the world to Canada, Latin America, Africa, lining up natural resources to sustain their growth. What have we done? We've become the policemen of the world. We have 1,000 military bases around the world. We have 11 aircraft carriers, 5,000 sailors per aircraft carrier. Now, I want to just pause and say, look, I'm not saying or suggesting we need to be an isolationist. We don't need 11 aircraft carriers. They're sitting ducks. Now, you may have seen last week in the news, in one of the Senate committees, Senator McCain and others bore down because a new aircraft carrier, the Gerald Ford aircraft carrier, which is supposed to be completed in 2015, the cost overruns have gone out of sight, cost plus. So let me just take you down an avenue on a couple of other accounting situations, accounting budgeting. A couple of weeks ago, I had dinner with a very bright lady, and I knew what she was going to tell me when we got into it. She runs a department for the interior, okay? She's given each year a budget, fair enough. As the year goes on, let's say the end of the year she does a great job in running her department. You can't with the government saying she's made a profit, but let's say she's going to end up with a nice surplus. You would think, well, okay, she can use it next year. Wrong. What happens? She loses it. She not only loses it, she's told by her superiors, we gave you too much money. So what does she do? She says it's terrible. During the last 3 or 4 months of the year, if it looks like I'm not going to spend the money, I spend it in any direction. She says it's waste. When is some politician going to stand up and say, look, enough is enough? Now, when Secretary Panetta took his position as head of defense through reliable sources, we are told that he went ahead and asked for a list of the vendors for the Defense Department. What was he told? Oh, we can't give you that. It's somewhere between $1 million to $10 million. We can't give it to you because we don't have an audit that's complete. I encourage you, go to Google, put in there the words audit and I think you can go, it's federal government military, and read what comes up and cry. We can't even produce a current decent audit. So I would say to you, the next time somebody says, hey, let's raise taxes, I would say, okay, we'll raise taxes, but how about telling me where the money's going and it isn't going to be wasted? So the whole military issue is complex. Now, should we be spending money on cyber warfare? You bet. And by the way, there are job opportunities there. The government's spending money, but not enough. Okay, let's shift now to, I'm going to use New York as an example. And I know some of you might have been in the class this afternoon and you've heard this, but I want to go back over because it's important. In my 34 years at First Maryland, we loaned money internationally. We loaned it on real estate. We made retail loans. We made commercial loans. The one area we never lost 5 cents on was on residential mortgage, because we happened to ask if an applicant came in for a 20% down payment and a verification of employment. 2 + 2 = 4. No brainer. If we'd all gotten in a car in 2008 and driven to Canada, which has 6 banks, we have 7,400, but they have 6 big banks. Those banks came through 2008 in beautiful shape, because if you went in there and asked for a residential mortgage, you were asked for a 20% down payment and you verified employment. Now we come back to New York and others. What did we do? What did a lot of the institutions do? They made residential mortgages with no down payment, no employment verification. They packaged the loans. Many times there were defective documentation. Then they sold them off around the world, and the board of directors went ahead and gave management millions of dollars of bonuses. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Now, let's go to Washington. What about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Mismanaged all the way down the drain. They're now wards of the state. Frank Raines, one of the key people running Fannie Mae, ended up with a $90 million retirement package. What about the Community Reinvestment Act, passed by Congress, signed by the president, which tells banks, financial institutions, to go ahead, in essence, make subpar residential mortgages? What about our bank examiners? The Fed has bank examiners. The OCC has bank examiners. The OTS has bank examiners. The state has bank examiners. First Maryland happens to have been an OCC bank. When the bank examiners came in back in the time that I was there, I can tell you, fortunately, we were clean. We were fine. But the examiners were thorough. If I had said at that time, well, we're going to make residential mortgages with no down payment and no employment verification, you know what? The board of directors and the examiners, they'd have thrown me out in the street. And they should have. Unbelievable. What happened to the credit rating agencies? Okay, enough on the U.S. for the moment. Let's go to Europe. Let's go to the euro. Now, we're talking obviously about 17 different countries in kind of a confederation, if you will. And that confederation, Margaret Thatcher once said, will never work. The mega state will never work. We'll see. Now, remember, each one of the countries, there's a different culture and different companies. Now, one of the key aspects here is that where does Germany fit in? Because they're really the key to the picture in many ways. Now, Mrs. Merkel obviously runs Germany. A lot of people don't realize she was born in East Germany. She grew up understanding what it was like to work hard and save money. She has a terrible time having the German taxpayers take their hard-earned money and ship it off to Greece. And I think we all know what's happening in Greece. There's one theory which says the euro is going to end up with a northern and a southern. The northern euro will be France, Germany up north, and the southern will be, obviously, Greece, Italy, Spain, and Portugal. Now, bear in mind, those in the southern part have already spent their inheritance. They're sick, and the sickest one is Greece. Now, the question is, will the euro stay put together? There's nothing in writing in the agreement on how you get out. And if you do get out, people don't realize it's an operational nightmare. You got to even reprogram the ATMs. But today, and of course I was had the pleasure of visiting classes today, so I'm a little out of touch on the agreement, but I know they've just come to an agreement on Greece. But that's kind of like, you know, rearranging the chairs on the deck. Now, in terms of Europe, there are two other issues. Well, there are a lot of other issues, but two I want to mention. One's liquidity, and one is sovereign debt, and those two are getting mixed together, okay? Now, the Basel agreements are requiring the banks in Europe, and by the way, the banks in Europe represent a larger percentage of the total economy than they do in our country. Those banks are being told to raise capital. Fair enough. But in raising capital, it means they're lending less, and by lending less, that's hurting any kind of growth possibilities. In addition to that, there's a whole basket, if you will, of credit default swaps, if you can find them all, which are sitting there. And then on top of that, which isn't talked about much, there is swap agreements between the Federal Reserve and the banking system in Europe, and I would submit to you that the American taxpayer is underwriting right now what's happening in Europe because the consequences if the euro collapses. So enough on Europe. We can come back to that later. Let's go. Now, all of this now is part of when we said, is there a light at the end of the tunnel? Part of what we're focusing on tonight is how one designs an investment portfolio. What are some of the considerations? So you clearly have to look at the Middle East. So what's happening in the Middle East? A collection of countries that have a young population in contrast to Japan. There are not enough jobs, a huge job shortage. You have military regimes on top, and you got the Arab Spring. Now, before we go to the subject of oil in Iran, let me just pick the biggest country, and a key one is Egypt. What about Egypt? You got a population there with a lot of illiteracy. They have to import energy and food. They live off of tourism, which has collapsed. Foreign reserves are going down, and they're begging the IMF for money. And on top of all that, the Muslim Brotherhood have a very nice foothold. So Egypt is complicated. It's also complicated in another way. If you go to U.S. foreign policy, the U.S. poured money for years into Egypt and was supportive of Mubarak as they were supporting in Syria and in Libya. Okay, so what happens then when the Arab Spring comes along, the U.S. does a reverse, goes against Mubarak, not gone unnoticed in Saudi. Saudi saying to itself, now would America abandon us? So Saudi's beginning to arm. Complicated issue. The point is, whoever's in the White House affects foreign policy, and that in the end can very much affect one's investment approach. Now, I want to comment just briefly on Iran and oil, because obviously oil in the Middle East is big. Now, the question is the U.S. or is Israel in the U.S. going to do anything in terms of the nuclear potential in Iran? My guess is no, because one, you got long flight times. You got 1,000 miles to fly from Israel. And if we go in there and bomb, Iran, I think, is a high probability they close the Strait of Hormuz. And instead of oil being at like 106 today, you can talk about 200 or 250 and you wreck the economy. Now, one last bit on the Middle East, because there's going to be a time issue after a while. My wife and I had the privilege, X number of years ago, being asked to go on a small group to Israel. And we met with Golda Meir. And we had an hour with her. And we were allowed to ask questions. It just so happened I asked the first question. Question was, will there be peace in the Middle East in my lifetime? 1 hour later, she was still talking. Answer, no way. So far, she's right. Now, granted, she comes from one point of view, but that was a personal experience. Okay, let's move on. Just a couple of comments on Russia. Big country, oil and natural gas are very important. They need $100 a barrel to make the budget balance. But the main thing on Russia, I mean, there's a lot we can talk about, just one big point. Pray for an evolution and not a revolution in terms of Mr. Putin, because things are beginning to heat up a little bit in terms of his popularity. Okay, let's go on. I'm not going to take time on India, very important, because I want to talk for a bit on China. Question is China, is this going to be their century? Big question, important question. I know there's some China experts in the house. But now, let's start by saying we owe, the U.S. owes China, roughly $1.2 trillion. There's a lot of rhetoric out there criticizing China. Guess what? We borrowed the money. It's our fault. It's not China's fault that we owe them $1.2 billion. So that's point number one. Point number two, obviously we're talking about something like $1.3 billion in people. Do you know by 2020, there'll be 131 cities in China with 1 million people, and some of them will have 8 million. So we're talking about an explosion of people. And there's a big difference between the coast and the interior. China has grown, as most of you know, in recent years by infrastructure and exports. That's got to change, is changing, as it shifts more to a service economy. Now, and I'm fully aware of the fact that China has pollution problems, has real estate problems, but don't forget in China, on the real estate, and they do have real estate problems, a lot of times when someone buys a house, they buy it for cash, and China, the people in China save roughly at 30%, where in this country we're terrible, we're five or lower. So the Chinese can save money. Now, I want to go a little bit on a side street and come back. I think it's important. I want to go to Singapore. Mr. Lee ran, he's now 89, he ran Singapore for 30 years. He started with absolutely nothing, and over the 30-year time frame, now nothing's perfect, this is what Mr. Lee has produced. Now he's out of office now. One, if you go to Singapore, and some of you have been there, there are no ghettos. The crime rate, tiny. Their debt level, fine. A huge emphasis on quality education. Teachers are paid well. If you want to go into government, and you can, this is like getting through the eye of a needle, they'll pay you $1 or $2 million if you're in the upper echelon. They really want to attract all the talent they can into government. The reason I'm covering this is Mr. Lee was the person that Deng Xiaoping conferred with when he went about the huge task of redirecting China. I had the privilege many years ago, at that time, Governor Harry Hughes was our governor, and he established the first trade mission between the state of Maryland and the Anhui province in China, sister state. And I happened to have been picked to represent the financial community. So we went to China, and one of the things we did, we had dinner with Deng Xiaoping in the Great Hall. There was an interpreter, and that was a unique experience. Let me just say, little man, big brain. What he did in terms of redirecting that country was really fabulous. Now, the reason I'm emphasizing that is that this is the year we have a change in leadership in China. And the question is, the two key people coming in, what do we have? The evidence is, too early to tell, I doubt we have Deng Xiaoping number two. Deng Xiaoping, by the way, had spent time in France. His contemporaries had spent time in Shanghai, cosmopolitan. The leaders coming in had spent most of their time in Tibet and other territories. It's doubtful that the new leadership is coming in is going to be of that caliber. We keep our fingers crossed. In the meantime, what the U.S. is doing foreign policy-wise is putting a much bigger emphasis now on the Pacific. We're now building up some military capabilities in Australia. And so I think going forward, it's going to be very delicate because what we're doing, we are monitoring very closely in the South China Sea what's going on there. Just think for a moment. Suppose China starts to do the same thing off of Washington. I'm not too sure we'd be happy. But anyway, the change in leadership this year on China is extremely important. Now, let's go in a completely different direction, and that is the shaping of an investment portfolio. And we got into this a lot this afternoon. I'm going to start off by saying my favorite investor is Warren Buffett. I want to talk about him in Berkshire for a little bit. The first thing Warren Buffett would say to you if he was here, you got to have liquidity. Always have dry powder. So in 2008, when GE and Goldman Sachs went into trouble, he was able to come up and go in and save them. He has probably $40 billion in cash right now. He never lets it go below 20. And people keep asking, what's the magic formula? Why is 20 billion? Where'd you come up with that number for? And he has the perfect answer, which is, it allows me to sleep at night. That's the number. Wouldn't you like to have 20? But he's running a big operation. So that's item number one. You gotta have liquidity. Very important. And we don't have time tonight, but let me just say, I really want to put this, because we're here at fabulous Dickinson, and the investment committee here, the endowment, did great on that time. Maybe we'll come back on the institutional side. We'll stay on the individual side at the moment. Number two, he believes in diversification big time, big time. So what do I mean by that? He has his own railroad. He bought the whole railroad. A huge cash flow coming out of the railroad. Now, in addition to that, he has an energy subsidiary, MidAmerican, that's in oil, gas, and everything from solar to wind. So he's got that covered. He has a big position in real estate, and granted, he's been hurt lately, but in due course, real estate will get well. We have too many houses now. It will get well. He'll benefit. Huge position in insurance. He owns GEICO and a whole bunch of insurance companies. And he's riding the float, making a lot of money there. In addition to that, in addition to the 75 companies he owns, he has an investment portfolio which is roughly $750 billion. $75 billion. In there, what does he have? He recently has bought $11 billion of IBM, which is the back office of the world. He owns 5% of Coke, global. He owns a huge position in Wells Fargo. Huge position in a number of other companies. I won't go through them all at the present time. But what I really want to stress, and because I happen to think it's still valid, many don't, he's a believer in buy and hold. Not 100%, but mostly. When he bought Coke, he bought it decades ago. When he bought Wells Fargo, he bought it decades ago. And he, after he goes through all the analysis, he buys it and locks it away. However, a lot of the pros today say, that's out the window. That's out the window. I enjoy every day when I can at 5 o'clock on CNBC listening to the fast money traders. And there we're looking at calls, we're looking at puts, and we're looking at credit default swaps and all the rest. That's the world that we've gotten to. Things are moving very rapidly. People don't want to buy and hold. Now, there's more here. What also is happening is something called high frequency trading. And there, stocks are bought and sold in the matter of seconds without any analysis of the company. This is not good. I wish I could wave a wand and it would disappear. But high frequency trading is a big problem. Now, what else if I were designing an investment portfolio might I have in there? You might want to have some timber. Timber is really good in terms of protecting against inflation and deflation. You might also want to have some MLPs, master limited partnerships, because you don't get the volatility of the commodity market, but you do get significant cash flow, and you get up to 90% tax deferral, which is very nice. So these are just a few ideas on the investment side. So let me shift to another piece of the equation tonight. How do we get the U.S. economy moving again? How do we get job creation? Let me just tick through a few important points here. The U.S. multinationals are in fabulous shape. By the U.S. multinationals, I mean the IBMs, the Caterpillars, the Exxons. They've made a lot of money abroad, paid taxes abroad, and $2 billion is sitting abroad. It ought to be back here where it can be put to work and used. But it's not back here because of the tax structure. The current administration says, well, we don't want to adjust the tax structure because if the money comes back, suppose the companies go ahead and increase dividends or do buybacks. We don't want that. I say, you're missing the point. A lot of the stock of the multinationals are owned in pension funds, which represent a lot of Americans. Or you could design it such, if you bring X amount of dollars home, we won't tax you. If you go out and hire X number of employees, that's simple. Let's go to the next one. I want to talk about Michael Milken, very bright, made some mistakes years ago, paid the penalty. Now he has a foundation, doing a great job, focuses on health care. He says after all of his work, if this country would address the obesity issue, there's $1 trillion of savings right there. $1 trillion of savings, enormous in terms of the health care system and job creation. Let's go to the next one. Infrastructure. My wife and I happen each August to do 2 weeks of trekking in Switzerland. The mountains are getting taller. They're beautiful. Now, when we sit in the Zurich airport, or if you happen to be sitting in the Singapore airport, then you say to yourself, oh my goodness, let's think about Kennedy and LaGuardia and Amtrak. It's an embarrassment. Do you know there are 50 dams in this country on the watch list? One of those dams breaks, a whole town's wiped out. There's sewers, there are roads, there are bridges. We should have a Marshall Plan, in my opinion, in terms of going ahead and creating jobs. Very important. Very important. Now, let's go to health care for a moment. Now, I'll use this as an example because being from Baltimore. There was a time when I went to work many moons ago. Bethlehem Steel was the largest employer, employed 32,000. Gone, all gone. If you look at Baltimore today, Hopkins Hospital, Hopkins University, University of Maryland Medical System, University of Maryland of Baltimore. Now, there are a few companies like T. Rowe Price left. Basically, Baltimore is a medical hub, if you will. There are job opportunities in that field. Job opportunities, by the way, in foundations. So there are lots of areas that we can really start job growth. Now let me go to Germany for a moment. The start there of the third industrial revolution. Think horizontal, think internet, think green energy, okay? You can't get a permit in Germany to build a big office building unless it is energy self-sufficient. You'll be able to drive a car up against the building and get refueled. It's creating all kind of jobs, and we're like 3 or 4 years behind it in this country. Or take energy itself in this country. we have enough natural gas here to last us for 100 years. There's all kinds of job opportunities in the whole energy field in the U.S. Now, let me shift again now to if looking for John Noe, which of interest to definitely some people in this room would be, what do you do in terms of jobs going forward? Where do you look? Well, first off, if you want to be a doctor or a lawyer or a nurse, by the way, if you want to be a nurse, guaranteed employment in an aging population, or you want to be an architect, you want to be a teacher, you go up a certain avenue. Let's set that aside. Let's say you're looking at just the broad economic environment for employment. One of the things I would do is if you look at the multinational corporations, which are doing great, I repeat, the Procter & Gambles, the Caterpillars, the Exxons, the IBMs, they have executive management teams and staff that all they're doing is looking for where the company can grow. Where are their job opportunities? I'd get those annual reports. I'd go through. I'd call them up and see if, you know, their job opportunities there. But then I'd go to the next level. I'm going to use the example of T. Rowe Price just because I'm from Baltimore. I could easily use Fidelity or Vanguard. Let's just use T. Rowe. T. Rowe has a fund called the New Horizon Fund. Okay, what does that fund do? That fund focuses at small companies, medium-sized companies, not the multinationals. They have all these analysts looking for companies that are growing, that they believe in. I'd call up T. Rowe. I'd get the prospectus for those companies. And those that companies that interest you in X, Y, Z line of work, I'd call them up and see if it's a job there. Now, let me shift over and put up a red flag on jobs. Think of the digital revolution. Think of artificial intelligence, and think of robots. And you want to be careful here. Robots are talking to each other. They're tied into the cloud. And I can tell you, the robots going forward in that arena, you don't want to get in the way of the robot 5 years out in terms of your job. So I'd be, now, if you're going to work for a company that's making robots, fine. Let me just cite some example of what's going to happen on robots. A chest x-ray. Someone's being paid a couple $100,000 to read your x-ray. A robot will do it. It doesn't get tired. It doesn't need health care. It'll work 7 days a week. Robot will read it. You want to call up and reorder a prescription? A robot will handle it. Robot will grade papers. Robot will drive cars. Obviously, if a robot can handle a drone, they can drive cars. So it's an area which is exploding. If you want to have fun and look at a good investment, think of FANUC, Japanese company, in robots. A few people turning out just tons of flat-screen TVs. That's just one. Or ABB. I mean, there are different companies you want to look at in that area. But that's a caution. It's a job opportunity, but also you don't want to end up 5 years from now and your job's wiped out by a robot. But believe me, it's a serious, serious matter. Now, how are we doing? How are we doing on time? Great. I don't want to overstay my welcome. Let's shift to. We probably ought to go to questions in a moment, but let me just come back to Warren Buffett for a moment. I want to repeat: if you're born in America, you've won the lottery. Americans' best days are ahead. Now, let me expand on that. Now, because I know I've touched on a lot of points tonight which have to worry you. I hope they worry you. But look at America. If you look at it from an agricultural point of view, we're in great shape. You know, there are people, and I know you know this, there are people around the world living on a dollar a day. There are countries in deep trouble in agriculture. We're in great shape. We're exporting. How about energy? There are companies like Egypt's in real trouble on energy. We have enough natural gas for 100 years. We haven't developed it properly, plus the fact we have coal and oil too. So we're in good shape there. We believe in immigration. We don't want illegal immigration, but immigration is important. The country was founded on that. Japan, they don't want to touch it. I think big mistake, big mistake. Our country believes in immigration. It's very important. Now, there's several other important ingredients in terms of going forward. Another one would be we have a growing population in this country. Now, some people would say that's not good. That is really good, and I'll tell you why. If you have a growing population, that means that down the road, people will need houses. And if you look at the U.S. economy, if you want to see it when it's really humming, real estate's doing well. So when you're growing your population, sooner or later, whether it's 3 or 4 more years out, this real estate disaster we're in, particularly on the residential side, is going to be behind us. That's a plus. So these are just some of the pluses. Now, let me just kind of weave in a couple of my favorite stories. One would be when they interviewed Muhammad Ali years ago. Some would say he's the greatest fighter ever. I happen to think it's Sugar Ray Robinson, but that's my own view. They interviewed Muhammad Ali, and they said to him, when you climb in the ring, that's tough. That's tough going. He said, no. When I climb under those lights, that's easy. What's hard, the fight is won and lost far away from the witnesses, out on the road, in the gym, the months of preparation, so that when I climb under the lights, it's easy. I say to you, you will climb under the lights many times. Be prepared. The chances of winning go way up. Just a thought. Here's another one. The Financial Times, my favorite paper, some time ago did an article on Bill Clinton. As you know, when Bill Clinton was president, he had a Republican Congress. So one day, the article spells out very clearly, he was sitting in the Oval Office. Someone from the other party was sitting across the desk. He couldn't have a meeting of the minds. So finally he said, you see that rock on my desk? I had that rock sent to me from Cape Canaveral. It came from the moon. It's 3 or 4 billion years old. We're just passing through. Let's make a deal. So what I'm saying to you, we're here for a very short time. Make it all count. Make every day count. So the other thing I would say, you're going to reach the top, all of you. When you get there, keep climbing. I'm ready for questions.
We will now begin the question and answer session. Please raise your hand and the microphone will be brought to you.
Maybe time to go to bed, right?
Thank you, Mr. Cole. Michael Fratantuono, International Business and Management. I enjoyed breakfast very much as well. And thank you for emphasizing ethics over breakfast. What opportunities do you perceive in the area of green technology for United States in light of the challenges to, I think, all human beings?
So let me just be sure I understand. In other words, you're asking me,
do we have an opportunity to emphasize alternative energy sources? You emphasized coal and gas.
Yes.
I worry about global warming.
Yes.
How would you square those two?
Right.
Thank you.
Good. Let me make a try at this in terms of energy and alternative energy. In terms of fossils, I think what is at least not articulated enough is that the depletion factor on fossils is huge. Now, if you happen to believe that and think it's a valid concept, then it leads to the conclusion that the price of oil can go a good bit higher. And I'm saying that excluding for the moment that say, Israel and the U.S. do something with Iran. So you have the issue, the world really runs on oil, and it should run more on oil and gas. Now, do I think that solar and wind have a place? Yes, but it's tiny. It just scratches the surface. So that's my, if I'm hopefully reacting to your question.
First, thank you for an extraordinarily wide-ranging lecture. I guess I'm interested in how you would deal with what looks to be a contradiction between, on the one hand, the real worries about national debt, and on the other hand, the call for massive investment, typically by government, in infrastructure. And so how do we balance out those two imperatives, both of which are very real, but they seem to move in opposite directions?
Yes. Good question, and I would break the answer down short and long term. Let's take it from a short-term point of view. Do we need to have more stimulus at the present time, not only here but in Europe? Absolutely. Now, that means increasing the national debt further, which I have a terrible time with. Longer term, we have to take a completely different approach to attacking the debt situation, because I go back to that number I cited to you, $100 trillion in unfunded liabilities. Not this year, not next year, 8 or 9 years out, I can make an argument we go bankrupt. Now, there are those who will say that isn't going to happen when you got a reserve currency, because the reserve currency will print. And there's no doubt about it. We will print money. We're printing money now. Europe's printing money. The problem is that in a democracy, ultimately, all roads lead to inflation. And then when you have inflation and it really picks up and the bond vigilantes return, all you're doing is, in essence, raping the public of their net worth. So that's a major worry. And I don't see how. At least my guess is this country is going to travel the avenue of ultimately reflating, which country after country have done this over time, rather than doing, and here's just one small example. Remember back in the 80s when inflation and things really got bad? Volcker came in as head of the Fed, and he administered some tough medicine, and it worked. Go back a few years into Sweden. Sweden got itself in a real bind. Then it went through several years of real pain. Sweden's in pretty good shape. It's in pretty good shape. It can be done. Look at Norway, good shape. Someone's going to say, okay, they have oil, discount it. Go to Singapore. Granted, not a huge country, magnificently run. It can be done. And at the end of the day, the big problem has been in many, get me going on this again, it's been greed and incompetence. It goes back to what Einstein said. And so I don't know if I've confused you, but yes.
Hi, Mr. Cole. I'm Jeb. I'm a senior. Yep. Thank you for being here tonight. But I had a question. I know you briefly touched on the credit default swaps and all the different things. There have been a lot of villainizing of some of the people that took advantage of, I guess what you could say, an imperfection. From your position and your past positions, what's your perspective and what's your take on whether these people in the market have been more of seen as unethical or you think more ingenious? So,
I want to be sure. The last couple of sentences, if you could rephrase that, I want to be sure I understand.
Well, over the past, several years, mm-hmm. and reading into the current economic crisis, you see some characters from different hedge funds and capital management firms seeing the bubble, if you will, on the subprime crisis. And so my question was, from your perspective as CEO of a large investment bank, how do you perceive those people that brought up credit default swaps and bet against subprime bonds?
Okay, I think you've asked several questions. Now, there's no doubt that we want to whatever degree we can, have a free market. So if someone wants to go in and bet the other side of the, call it, equation, okay, here's where one of the problems really comes up. And I'm just going to cite Goldman Sachs for the moment, because obviously there's been enough litigation on that. And one of the big arguments on Goldman Sachs is that they were on both sides of the equation. That's a no-no. And so I have a terrible time with that. Now, kind of going a step further, I think for those individuals, too late now, that caused all the damage to all of us, they should be clawbacks. The fact that they walk away, I'll cite the position and not the name. At one point, there was a chairman of Citicorp, okay? And, of course, Citicorp went down, down, down. And the board of directors did nothing. And he'd make the following statement. I have a contract that says I have no operational responsibility. Give me a break. Inexcusable. So in those cases, and he walked away with a lot of money, flying around on the corporate jet. So I'm for clawbacks. Frank Range never should have walked off with $90 million out of Fannie Mae after it was wrecked, and some others did the same. So, but on the other hand, if someone is running a legitimate business and they want to short the market, I think it's their right to do it as long as there's not a conflict of interest in there and someone else is being hurt in that sense. I don't know whether I've... Yeah.
Mr. Cole, thank you for being with us. My name is Nick Leon. I'm a junior here. My question pertains to your touching on China.
Yeah.
In terms of your forecast for them, you said that, you know, is it possible for them to be, for it to be their century? Amid their massive pollution problems and then the possibility of their population uprising against the current government, do you think that it could be their century, and do you see that as a possibility for them in the coming years?
Well, you've clearly touched on the hot buttons. Too much pollution, you bet. Too much pollution now in Hong Kong is unreal. So that needs to be addressed. You have in China today a high percentage of cities that are very short of water. Water, in many ways, is going to be more important than oil. And on that whole topic right now, when you go to the Himalayas, the proper pronunciation is Himalayas, the glaciers there are melting faster. That's affecting the water flow into both China and India, and that can lead to war. So China has a ton of problems. Real estate, you could easily have, let's call it an Arab Spring, but it could be a Chinese Spring. And that's what at least a lot of the literature says today, that the leadership in China is running scared, in contrast to Deng Xiaoping, who took bigger leaps forward, bigger risk. But remember, he was closer in time-wise to Mao Zedong in terms of the population accepting the push that he put forward. So, you know, we'll just have to wait to see on China. But one thing's for sure, their economy will be bigger than ours.
Yeah. Won Young Kim, International Business and Management. Thank you for the lecture, Mr. Cole. I have a question about the residential mortgage. So as we addressed in the lecture, the securitization of the residential mortgage. is key, one of the key factors that our subprime mortgage crisis spread to the world. But basically, the securitization itself are very beneficial to make the borrowers to borrow the money easily. So what do you think about the balance between the benefit and the cost of the like MBS or CDOs? And what do you suggest to the effective way to regulate the residential mortgage market?
Okay. I think I understand the question. So let me make a run at it. On the mortgage picture, let's first kind of get over the hurdle that we went through where the country, at least the administration, was saying everybody should have a house. Everybody should have a house in America. We know that everybody can't afford a house. I'm not going to go here right now. I'm looking down at healthcare. A lot of people are saying that everybody in America has a right to health care. That's another issue. I know you didn't ask that. And the question is, well, is the health care issue any different from the housing? Or is one a privilege and the other a right? So on the housing issue, I guess which kind of blows my mind, back, and this is some time ago, when I ran First Maryland, it wouldn't even occur to me, and I want to stress again, that was the one loan category. We didn't lose any money for 34 years. It would never have occurred to me to do what was done in terms of making residential loans with no down payment, no employment verification. Now, if we had tried that, the bank examiners, if they're doing their job, would have cut your neck off. So today, with all of this regulation we hear about, I say to myself, look, the regulation was in place then if somebody was doing their job. And yet we're going ahead with, you know, all of this legislation, which is costing the banking industry a ton. Now, the flip side of that is, look, the bankers misbehaved. Their performance was appalling. Look at the damage they've done. But yet at the same time, all the regulation is a huge cost factor there. And let me just say, and this is completely away from your question, but it's a coordination issue. Take Steve Jobs. We know what job he did. Fabulous, okay? So here comes Apple. Why are we having apples made in China and not here? It's because we can't create in this country, between the federal government and the state, a business-friendly environment, so we're manufacturing here. Why does it have to be done in China? But that's where it's being done, because the Chinese have a business-friendly environment for Apple. So you didn't ask that, but it just triggered a thought I wanted to weave in. Okay. Yeah.
I want to come back to the subprime mortgage crisis. Mm-hmm. After done researching on it, I came to a topic of the credit rating problem, where they have a bunch of different problems with the transparency of rating other companies, which lead to the crisis. So I just want to ask for your opinion on how to fix that, because it's really difficult. Should we regulate the credit rating companies, or should we leave them alone for them to be fair? But certainly something needs to be done in the credit rating industry so that could improve the banking industry in general.
Okay, if I understand the question, let me go through the loop again just to kind of reiterate something that we've touched on. We've had management deficiencies. We've had deficiencies at the federal government in terms of the Community Reinvestment Act. We have deficiencies with the bank examiners. So at the end of the day, in terms of the credit rating agencies, did they drop the ball? You bet. Credit ratings meant nothing. Now, the question is, How do you address that? Do you regulate them? Well, that's a toughie. Once again, greed and stupidity brought it about. And you know, I can stand here and say, look, credit rating agencies were a disaster. They need to be regulated. And then if you regulate them, then the problem is, do you over-regulate them? Do you have intelligent regulators? Does Congress have the intelligence to draft legislation that's not 3,000 pages long that nobody's read? So anyway, I've danced around that, but it's a good question.
We have time for two more questions.
Hi, Mr. Cole. Thank you very much for your talk tonight. I'm Jeff Troxel at the Army War College. And I want to go back to China and apples and maybe even Bethlehem Steel. There are some people that will make an argument that the reason we don't produce Apple computers here and perhaps the reason that Bethlehem Steel is no longer operative down in Baltimore is that China has manipulated their currency and gained an unfair competitive advantage. And so it really sort of a three-part question. One is, do you think, based on your experience, that China is in fact a currency manipulator? The second point is, if in fact they are, is that a significant contributor to the loss of manufacturing jobs in America? And then the third question is, what do we do about it in the United States?
Well, I can almost go up the political avenue because Mr. Romney says, go get China, you know, sock it to him. And I sit here and say, as an ex-banker, when you owe somebody $1.2 trillion, be careful. Be very careful. Because at the end of the day, I mean, it would hurt China to do anything. But, you know, they do hold the cards in that sense. And they are, and we didn't get into this tonight, China and others, they're gradually at the central bank beginning to build gold positions because they are beginning to obviously question our currency going forward. So on the question of going after them, I'd be very careful. Are they probably a currency manipulator? You bet. You bet. They play hard. But on the other hand, I guess it all comes down to diplomacy, which is, you know, that's fuzzy. But we need to work with the Chinese. And that's not easy, but if you have competent people in diplomacy, you need to try to, you know, level the playing field more. So that's part of an answer.
Hi, I'm a student, international business and management. I have a question also about China. Now, like in these 30 years, America have a lot of like new creativity for the financial world, like a swap and different derivative. What do you think of it? And also for China, because in China they don't have swap and like the bank is really careful when they try to lend the money for the people. So does it mean China can get rid of the economic crisis caused by the housing market? And what do you think about it?
Okay, I need you. Can you repeat the question? I'm sorry.
I'm just wondering, like, can China get rid of the housing, this kind of crisis, because China is more careful trying to lend money to the lender instead of so much creativity for the financial like product like a swap or something like that?
Okay, so I gather your question is the Chinese and their real estate issue, correct? Okay. Do they have a real estate problem? Yes. Is it totally out of hand? No. Let me give you a couple of examples. Again, I want to stress, the Chinese save money. We don't. A lot of the properties are bought for cash or they make a major down payment. They save a lot of money there. Now, yes, they do have a real estate problem. It's not like Japan many years ago. Remember when the Japanese palace, the value on the Japanese palace at one point in time was valued more than all the real estate in California. So is it a problem? Yes. Is it completely out of hand? No. Now, China is managed through a number of really large, call it corporate entities. They're enormous. They're sinfully profitable. China needs very much to turn around and to broaden the base so that the smaller entities can do better. And this will also help in terms of the whole real estate issue. So I don't know whether I've confused you on that, but it's, I don't think the real estate issue brings China to its knees. Hurts them? You bet. It doesn't bring them to the knees.
President Durham will now present the Rush Award to Mr. Charles Cole.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yes. Charlie, it gives me great pleasure to present you with the 2011-2012 Benjamin Rush Award in recognition of your outstanding achievements in the field of banking. And as we heard tonight, you're also your insistence on integrity in banking, which is very critical, and your strong leadership in your community. Charlie, here we have a medallion featuring somewhat of a likeness of Benjamin Rush. It actually looks like Benjamin Franklin, if you want to be frank about it. I think we got the Benjamins messed up there, but nevertheless, no, it is. It is BR, I can tell.
Well,
congratulations.
Yes,
thank you. Congratulations.
Yes.
It's a privilege and an honor to be here. I thought this was going to be gold.
Yes, well, we reserve that for ourselves. We sort of keep that. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for being here. Charlie?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.